Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. We're going to look today at the Gospel according to St. Matthew, chapter 13, verses 1 through 23. It is the famous parable of the sower who went out to sow the seed. And he said, imagine a sower going out to sow, and some fell on the edge of the path, and the birds came and ate it. Others fell on patches of rock, found little soil sprang up, but straight away, because there was no depth of soil, as soon as the sun came up, they were scorched. Not having any roots, they withered away. And others fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up, and it choked them. And others fell on rich soil and produced their crop, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. Listen, anyone who has ears. All right. We're very familiar with this parable, and we're very, very familiar with Jesus' explanation of that parable to his disciples. One of the interesting things in the parable is, while it seems so clear to us, so crystal clear to us what he's talking about, the disciples were somewhat perplexed, and so he had to explain it to them. And yet, he had a natural model to explain it for them. And this is something I thought, you know, it's not legitimate actually to do with a parable basically what I'm going to do, because basically Jesus tells us what it means, and that parable means only what Jesus says. And a parable is different than an allegory, because a parable conveys one insight, one idea, whereas in an allegory, we can take the story apart and look at different pieces of it. For instance, if we were to distort the story of the Good Samaritan, we would feel ourselves free to go around trying to think, what did the oil symbolize, what did the wine symbolize, what did the inn symbolize, and so forth. Whereas basically, it's an idea, and that is that everyone, all of God's children, in some way, shape, or form, are our brothers and sisters. So this is the difference then. So what Jesus is saying is clear, but it struck me as I was reading this parable, I was reflecting upon it and wondering what's kind of a commentary might be helpful to me in the pulpit, to people who I might talk to. What might we see in this that might be helpful to us? And I think one of the things, and this is true not only of this parable, but of many parables, one of the things that struck me is that Jesus is using the natural order in order to draw attention to the meaning of what he is saying. In other words, he's using his creation, that which he created, to tell for him a story about faith and salvation. Now, the intention of this parable is strictly to talk about faith and the disposition toward faith. But on the other hand, what does it mean to use natural realities in order to reflect an authentic relationship between the believer and Jesus Christ? What happens to these natural images that are designed from the very order of creation to illuminate our minds about the relationship that exists between God and ourselves? What happens when we distort that nature, when we change it so that the created responses and images that we have do not, and it is not creation itself that begins to form our understanding, our relationship with God, but instead of that, it is the constructs, the creations, and even the sinfulness of humanity that replace the primitive parable of nature, and in so doing, distort also our image of the divine. We hear a great deal today about the crisis of the environment. We know that there is a tremendous politicization of science, and perhaps that has always been the case, but it is particularly blatant today. and that somehow or other the scientific discoveries and so forth get processed through the political lenses of the modern world. And in many ways, shape, and form, we therefore can distort nature, and instead of having it a creature of God, we make it a creature created by ourselves. This process began back probably in the French Enlightenment of the 17th century, and particularly through a particular philosopher who had decided that the natural world is somehow or other inanimate. There is no internal dynamism oriented toward growth and change and so forth. But the only thing that affects nature, he said, the only thing that affects nature is the human mind, the human desire. And in so doing, he destroyed millennia of religious understanding of the harmony between Christian faith and the world, the created order in which we live. We can see, for instance, in the Middle Ages, St. Bonaventure talking about the vestiges of God in the created order. And he says that, in the learning from Francis, he says that since the Lord is present in all the created order, that by finding those things which reflect his goodness, his beauty, and his wisdom, and all of that, we catch glimpses in the creature, we catch glimpses of the Creator as well. And so Bonaventure was very adamant about the fact that nature reveals to us the created God, the Creator God, and in so doing reveals to us something about ourselves as those who live in a symbiotic relationship with the nature that comes forth from the hand of God. The Church celebrated that in the old liturgies, in the Ember Days, and in the blessings of crops and fields and so forth, that there was an ebb and a flow based on the seasons and based on nature that helped us to understand the importance of this harmony between the created order and ourselves as creatures created by the living God. But from the 17th century on, that relationship became disoriented and it became disordered. And we began to believe through the Newtonian Revolution and so forth that somehow or other we were in charge of what nature was supposed to become and how it was supposed to be used. In the age of utilitarianism, nature became simply a utilitarian entity used for our convenience and our comfort. We had no sense whatsoever of living in any kind of harmony with it anymore. The whole Christian concept of the integrity of creation and the harmony of creation was shattered by the rationalist age and the world and the Enlightenment world of Europe in the 17th and 18th and even into the 19th centuries, where nature became kind of a mechanical phenomenon with very little sense of its kind of being a living being. Those, of course, who stayed on the land, those who stayed in the agricultural field, were more sensitive and more aware of that kind of harmony and that kind of relationship. They formed, in a way, a bond with nature, figuring out how also, while preserving nature, to take care of human needs as well. As the cities grew, this all became somewhat distorted because we all became radically separated from the natural order of the world. And everything around us was created by human hands and human minds. The buildings, the sidewalks, the streets, the entertainment centers, all of this kind of thing became human creations. And we began then to change a fundamental perspective. And as the countryside tended to empty out and people fled into the cities and so forth, we gradually lost the sense of a rhythm of nature. And so we then became even more convinced of the Enlightenment foolishness that somehow or other nature was an inanimate object there for us simply to use. I remember several times, exposing maybe young people unaware to me about the source of the steaks that they ate or the hamburger that they ate or something like that, only to find, you know, some of them, young ones, reduced to tears and all upset about it because there was no connection. There was no relationship between the source and the origin of what nature provides for us and the reality of how it provides it. Well, taking this then, we say to ourselves, if in fact we have so distorted the natural world that to use a natural symbol, a natural parable, a natural idea becomes more and more subjected to the whim and to the will of the human being, of human society, so that when we try to equate the created order with the Creator, we find standing in between the simplicity of all of this, we stand in between their human activity, human desire, human control. And for instance, in the tale of the sower and the seed, if we were to see that in the modern perspective, a perspective that has to do with anybody familiar even with the process of food production in this country, what we find then is we're dealing with petroleum chemicals, we're dealing with all sorts of artificial fertilizers, we're dealing with $500,000 machines, we're dealing with all of that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden, there's something that separates us from what God created and from what we have created. Not that everything we create is bad, that's not so. We adapt to the needs of an age, the needs of a time. But to say now we're going to use natural imagery in order for us to have some kind of relationship, understand the harmony between the Lord and the world in which we live, now it becomes more complicated. Now it becomes more difficult. The parable of the sower has no resonance with a modern urban dweller. What does that mean? What is that all about? And so we try and we look and say, all right, you know, we do understand that seeds grow in dirt. We at least have that much of an awareness left. But it's not an ordinary image of our ordinary life. And so what happens then is it becomes somehow less potent for us, less directed toward us. And so we find that these obstacles that we have built between the created order and ourselves and failed somehow or other to keep any kind of perspective now damages our capacity to understand God as created. This human interference now, since probably the beginning of the 20th century at least, probably since the end of the First World War, has become embedded in a radical deconstructionist philosophical sort of way, in which the whole natural entity of the human person has been under siege and under attack. The radical feminist deconstructionists of the mid-20th century, people like Judith Butler and Jean Lyotard and some of the others, then began also to apply this Cartesian principle, this principle that all creation, all the material world, they would say, they would never say creation, but all the material world would in some way, shape, or form somehow has to be subject to human control and to human construction. Flowing out of an Enlightenment principle of the I as a self-creating self, as then somehow or other we have eliminated the Creator God. And so introduce then into the modern world as a revolt against the oppression of nature, against the oppression of, they say, of biology. Therefore, we then say, you know, that chemical contraception that poisons the body, poisons the waterways, and so forth, is now our right. And as a matter of fact, in the last administration, it became a mandate of all insurance policies sponsored and under the aegis of the government in the Health and Human Services mandate, which was a vicious assault upon the human person, the integrity of the natural person. We find then also abortion justified. We find all the homosexuality justified. We find all the transgenderism justified. All of these things are issues which we have every right to ponder, look at different possibilities, see it in different ways, try to understand it in the light of our Christian faith. But the very fact that somehow or other it is legitimated in the modern world because it is essentially denial of the Creator, which is the intention of contemporary secular philosophy, is to eliminate the divine completely from the whole experience of life of both nature and the human person. So this then, what do we do now when the Lord brings to us images of the created world, images of the created nature, in order to help us to understand in some way, shape, or form what our relationship is with Him, when we have replaced Him with human philosophy, with human wisdom, with human mechanization, with human interference? Again, you know, the great feminist deconstructionists of the mid-20th century, Jean Lyotard says, as a matter of fact, that you should use surgery in order to take control of yourself. Your body is simply a piece of plastic art that you can mold into whatever it is that you want to be, whatever your self-consciousness calls you to be. And certainly this is the philosophy that justifies this whole transgender craze. And even whatever the individual person's struggles might be, and we're not unaware of the fact that many people face deep, deep problems and difficulties and disorders within their own person, their own life. And it takes great compassion and understanding to find empathy with them and to be supportive of them and to be helpful to them in their human development and their faith development. But the idea that somehow, and I just saw something in the news the other day where some woman had a baby and said, well, they're not going to declare its gender because it should be free to choose its own gender. The ultimate liberation from biological oppression, according to the deconstructionists. It's a form of madness. This philosophy is a form of madness. Human beings become its victims, the victims of probably a vicious and a cruel human understanding of its own value, of its own worth, of its own power. It is certainly one of the great sins of humankind. It is the pride, and it is actually the sin of Eve. When, if you eat this, you will be like God. If I can create myself as I want myself to be, then I am my own God. And only that which I see and I want is normative or acceptable in my world. As we do this, there comes then collapsing down any kind of societal integrity. I don't think that we can certainly say, you know, well, everything old was good and everything new is bad. That's not true. There's tremendous developments in the wisdom and the insight of the proper human relationship to modernity. One of the radical examples of goodness, of course, was Mother Teresa. And that became very much an iconic part of a challenge to much secular modernity, to the point where she had bitter enemies, and many of them within the church, because she somehow or other saw the value of the human person who had not been reconstructed in their own image and likeness, but who suffered because of the way the world itself had turned away from the natural toward the artificial. What is the solution in this kind of philosophical entity for the world in which we live? It is a form of nihilism. And if there is an issue, if there is a problem, if there is suffering, if there is pain, if there is exclusion, forget the whole idea of the cross of Jesus Christ. Kill them. That's what we do. The child is going to be an interference in my life. Kill it. This old person is going to drain my resources and take up my time. It can't take care of itself. Kill it. The person is sick or emotionally distressed. Then Holland has come up with a solution. Kill it. Holland has has euthanized 416 people so far this year against their wish. So mass murder then becomes, it's, you know, that was the solution, that was Hitler's solution, was if anything is interfering in the world that I want to create, I must kill it. And so he saw within the progressivism and within the Jewish community a threat to the Third Reich because of the history of Judaism as somehow or other standing outside and not conforming always to the world in which it lives, killed them. It's really kind of shocking when we can say we can see very little difference, actually, in the mindset between Planned Parenthood and the Third Reich. They are connected through Margaret Sanger and through her Eugenics Institute at New York University. And so it's not an outrageous comparison because there's a deep connection. Many of the Nazi doctors, the famous Dr. Mengele, was implementing experimentations from the Sanger Institute on Eugenics. So the idea somehow or other that we can look disdainfully at the horrors of the past but look benevolently at the horrors of the present is, of course, a deceit and a self-delusion. And it is something that is destructive to humanity, destructive to the human race. It is for this reason, for instance, that Pope Benedict XVI spoke out in favor of the environment, not accepting necessarily the modern hysteria and the politicized science, that somehow or other things, nothing can happen in this world unless we cause it, unless we do it ourselves. And that's part of whatever the truth of global warming is, whatever the scientific foundation of that is, it certainly is disputed. But the fact is that the theorists, the ideologues, simply refuse to admit that something can happen naturally without human agency. And that's part of this turning humanity into its own God and determining the world in which we're going to live. I don't know, certainly none of us probably know enough about the politics of it or the science of it to be able to say yay or nay on the whole thing. But we certainly know that there's a huge debate within the scientific and the political community about it. And it's not legitimate, you know, for us to say, well, you know, it's thus or so, because we don't really know. But one thing we do know, that the philosophical foundation of much of the ideology of contemporary climate science is that it couldn't happen unless we did it ourselves, because it accepts this 20th century concept of the supremacy and of the human person, of humanity. And all things good, only we can do. All things bad, only those who disagree with us can do. But in any case, it's all human agency. It has nothing to do with the natural forces, and it has nothing to do with the Creator God. That's the danger. When we wrestle creation from the hands of the Creator and take charge of it ourselves, we become then, no matter what the outcome, agents of the destruction of the human person. Because as a matter of fact, the truth of the matter is that everything that we have is a gift from the Almighty Creator. And for us to be independent of that Creator, as modern secularism desires us to be, then it is our task and our job to take away from God that which belongs to Him and to bestow it upon ourselves. We see the foolishness from the 17th century on, and certainly there's cases before that, but this is when it becomes a philosophical school and a political school that take away from nature its own inner dynamic, its own inner life, bestowed upon it by the Creator, appropriate that to ourselves, reduce nature to simply an inanimate reality that is there to serve our purposes and our needs, and then to exploit it always for some kind of economic gain, instead of allowing us to develop in any way, shape, or form in a conformity with nature itself. We find that humanity, therefore, creates many of its own modern problems. What do you do What do you do with the terminally ill? How long do you keep them alive? What methods do you use? How long do you extend human life? What methods do you use? How do you determine the viability of a child, the viability of a born child, or the viability of an unborn child? That in no matter what the situation might be, they are a creature of God. They have their own special DNA. They are not an appendage of their mother. They are a dependency upon their mother. And it is that dependency which causes their vulnerability under civil law and deprives of them normal, natural human rights, civil rights. All of this is part of an issue that comes into our world through a denial of the Creator God and through a denial of the vitality of nature itself. We are dramatically reminded of that, usually in a negative way, tsunamis and tornadoes and hurricanes and so forth, that nature does not obey human commands, that it is a force of itself. We might be able to contribute to its altering, but we are not responsible solely for that which is, that it is, as a matter of fact, an independent life form within God's created universe, should be respected as such, should be honored as such, should be managed and dealt with as such. The very fact that when and if we lost the natural relationship with the land beginning in the 17th century, that's when we began stripping land, stripping forests, polluting, all of that kind of stuff. And it was basically synonymous with the growth of urban societies. Human urban societies should be able to grow also in a natural way. We recognize some of that with the insistence upon green space and all of that kind of thing. But harmony between nature and humanity is part of a key to the understanding of the harmony between humanity and the Creator God. We cannot destroy one without in some way destroying the other in our lives, in our world, in our understanding, in our thought. When, therefore, we hear the story of the sower who went out to sow his seed, remember that Jesus himself touched the natural ebb and flow of nature in the lives of the early peoples in order to enhance their grasp and their understanding of a proper relationship with the living God. And when we lose the capacity to do that in parabolic form, we lose our understanding of the world in which we live, and we open that world up to phenomenal human abuse, which has now gone on in our world, in our culture, for several hundred years. Heed the warnings, for instance, of Genesis. Heed the warnings of Pope Benedict, and reflect upon this natural relationship in which we should care for God's creatures rather than exploit them.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.
Veni, Sancte.